My Life as an Animal, Serialization, Week 10. This episode is brought to you by animalaid.org.uk, who campaign peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promote cruelty-free living.
It's now time to continue our audiobook here on UK Health Radio, My Life as an Animal, written by Andrew Tyler and read by Jim Smith.
My Life as an Animal. End piece. This 8,000-word article is how my memoir started, the first six paragraphs of which appear in the prologue at the beginning of this book. I had wanted to sign off from Animal Aid with an iconoclastic piece that took a scalpel to biomedical science and the veterinary profession. For various complicated reasons, I put the finished text aside and started again and kept going until the memoir was completed. Then I reread my first effort and decided that it said clearly and with some force what I had most wanted to say and therefore also deserved an airing. I hope you agree. While I used some parts of the end piece for the memoir, notably the prologue, by far the greater part of it was not included. These are just some thoughts starting, to my surprise, with the God of my childhood, a God I lost touch with many decades ago. I'm 70 now and physically ailing, but this isn't the story of somebody scrambling to embrace youthful certainties in the hope that it will pay off in that dark place beyond the grave. Rather, I'm thinking about the forces that control the way we think and the way we act. They leave us, it seems to me, fearful of trusting who we really are and fearful of daring to be that person. The God I grew up with is the God of the Old Testament. I was taught that he is a demanding, wrathful and jealous God, jealous in the sense that any thoughts we might have had of other gods were to be banished. We were forbidden even from speaking his name or from making graven images, which I took to be carvings of some sort. In case we elevated such objects to the status of God surrogate, I doubt that such a thing would have crossed my mind, as it happens, but the message was understood. There is one God only. He's infinitely mysterious, powerful, and prescient, and he was watching everything I did. Years later, what should have long ago been obvious finally occurred to me. God did not create human beings in his own image. It was the other way round. In a narcissistic masterstroke, man created God as an almighty manifestation of his own ambitious self. He created a divine ogre, the ultimate disciplinarian who had lightning bolts streaking from his fingers and thunder in his unraked silver hair. This God was everywhere in the Jewish children's home I grew up in with 200 other kids. The God from our Hebrew lessons and prayers saw everything. He saw into our gloomy dormitories with their creaky iron beds and splintery wooden floors. He knew the huge cracked enamel baths, the little upstairs synagogue, where, locked in a glass-fronted cabinet, were half a dozen holy scrolls, sheathed in purple felt that was embossed with gold Hebrew lettering. And he knew the names and deeds of the philanthropists whose somber portraits hung life-size from the walls of the communal dining hall. This God was everywhere and saw everything. He perched invisibly, permanently on my shoulder, watching me, watching the world, and always ready with a rebuke. He had, in the idiom of later times, Silicon Valley vision and Pentagon firepower. I was a skinny, anxious boy with a lively repertoire of tics, jerks, blowing and sucking that I did my best to suppress. A lot of the kids in that home were orphans. Others, like me and my two brothers, were sent there because family life was fractured. Into the mix, in our case, went alcohol, violence, secret affairs, one or more secret abortions, mental breakdown, and finally, the dispatch of we three boys to the South London orphanage. The place, the whole experience, was somehow exotic, I remember children from Hungary, Egypt, India, and Canada. There were blackberries and apples in the thorny, tangled perimeter where we played spies and assassins. We jumped off a fort parapet to prove that we weren't scared and exchanged love notes with the girls through impassive go-betweens. We ran, wrestled, climbed trees, and made camps in the wood. The flowers that still evoke those times are dandelions, buttercups, and daisies. The white, gold, and green. They were perfect creations of nature. Not loud and dazzling like flower show roses, but just as they should be. Later, I found out that these flowers I most admired were mere weeds. They were troublesome invaders that faced being uprooted or chemically poisoned on sight. But registering deeper than these spring and summer memories was the religious conditioning. It was there always in the prayers, the Bible history classes, the Hebrew lessons, and those Friday evening, Saturday morning, and Sunday afternoon synagogue services. They took you into an ancient world that was both lush and arid. Moses in the bulrushes, Jacob in the desert, God close at hand. He whispered into the ears of kings and prophets. Samson brought down the temple. Joseph had a coloured coat and he was his father's favourite. Battles were fought with terrible savagery. Years of plenty followed years of famine. The God of the Jews took his people to the edge of the abyss, but always pulled them back. Why could they not please their wrathful God, their jealous Father in heaven? All was passion and chaos in this ancient biblical world, and it lived on in the murmured prayers and cliffhanger tales that swirled around us in the children's home. We studied conventional subjects, such as maths, science, and English, in a regular school alongside regular, that is to say, non-Jewish boys. Mine was in Brixton, a 30-minute walk away in the morning, and an 8-minute bus ride back. There was nothing lush or chaotic about Aristotle Boys' School at the back of the Brixton Road. The kids screeched and chased each other during play breaks, like any other kids. But there was a premium on rationality and clear thinking. The teachers they hired were mostly undemonstrative types who could keep order in the classroom. And when discipline lagged, they would bring out the trusty enforcer, go to the headmaster's office and fetch the cane. The teachers had no designs on our souls. All they wanted was for us to pass exams. That meant filling us up with facts, everything from names of famous battles to how steel is made. They served up facts like they were life-saving rations. They pummeled us with them until we were groggy from so much learning. Remember enough facts, pass some exams, and you'll get a decent job. An office boy with prospects, or a tailor's assistant. Given time, it was impressed upon me there was nothing on Earth or in the far universe that couldn't be explained through science. A scientific fact, well tested, is a solid, dependable thing. And the formulae, theorems, and aggregated data of science were our best means of steering through times that, as I left school, were becoming increasingly scary. It was the late 1950s, early 60s. Europe's imperial holdings were crumbling and catching fire, and communism and capitalism would soon have a nuclear standoff over Cuba. On the day we expected the bomb to go off, I watched helplessly as a little bird tried to escape from the ground floor entrance of an office block into which she had strayed. I worked in the building as a filing clerk and T-boy. Over and over, while people waited for lifts, she flew at the glass panel above the open door, trying to bust through. She carried on until she was concussed and somebody went to find a ladder to reach up and rescue her. I don't remember how it ended, which is why, some 53 years later, it is still with me. The pain and bewilderment experienced by that little bird was for me, in that moment, more terrible than the prospect of atomic warfare in which millions of birds, millions of children would die or be left scorched and broken. A teacher at Aristotle told a class I was in that whatever the troubles faced by humanity, science can help resolve them. Science is method, the pursuit of truth through objective inquiry, during which veritable facts are assembled. Together, these facts reveal what has been hidden or confirm an existing supposition. You'll understand that this is my hazy adult recollection rather than a verbatim account. The fruits of science, especially when allied to engineering, he told us, are richly diverse. It could be a new kind of washing machine or a portable weapons system that is dazzlingly efficient at neutralizing an enemy. How could primitive religion, that wild neurotic thing, compete? All the same, I remember hating school science lessons. At Aristotle, it meant chemistry and physics, subjects that left me in the slow lane. I was never sure where chemistry ended and physics began. Both seemed to be the study of restless, invisibly tiny subatomic fragments, but also, as far as physics is concerned, the study of the universe in motion. Where, I would ask myself years later, does this infallible creed of science, especially biological science, take us? Infallible religion takes us to hatred of non-believers and eventually to righteous mass murder. But that is widely known. Where does unrestrained science go? And where was I to go? I left the orphanage and then my school when I was just 14, without ever having read a book, except religious volumes. I was also a hopeless exam taker. Leaving meant no more exam trauma. And, as a special bonus, there would be a liberating weekly wage packet. I was operating an old-fashioned plug-in switchboard for a City of London Greek shipping company when I read my first book. It was an Ian Fleming James Bond spy thriller. As I turned the pages, I was gone, nowhere to be found. I read more James Bond, then something similar from Len Deighton. Graduated to John le Carré before leaping skywards to take on Worlds in Collision by Emmanuel Velikovsky. This was several hundred times more exciting than Bond and le Carré. It described celestial turmoil some 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. Planets and comets were thrown into lethal trajectories, and a comet-like object passed so close to Earth that our home planet was thrown off its orbit and axis. The result was floods, fires, plagues, and other immense happenings that can be found in the myths of ancient cultures. One such happening, I recall, Velikovsky including, was the miraculous parting of the Red Sea for Moses and the fleeing Israelites. Velikovsky's soaring narrative enthralled me, but the science establishment detested it, and it was banned from a number of academic institutes. I quit the shipping company, and after a few more jobs, ended up in the trade magazine office, where I was to see the little bird fly repeatedly at the glass panel above the door. Within a couple of years, they made me a junior reporter. My reading now reflected my own urgent need to break free from patched-up, sooty England and breathe new air. I read something by Jack London, set in a snowy wilderness and featuring what was presented as a ravening, demonic creature that turned out to be Wolverine. Or maybe I'm mixing it up with something else. I recall more clearly the Jack Kerouac paperbacks I read while laid up in bed with a bug. There was his On the Road, done in hipster jazz lingo, which years later made for painfully embarrassing reading. Big Sur was a novel that made me promise myself that I too would one day trek that Southern California coastline. It was a promise I kept. I spent around half my 20s in Canada and the US. For a good part of it, I was an on-the-road love and peace hippie. Actually, head was the preferred term. The rest of my time, I did a variety of jobs, picking fruit, cleaning offices, filling up cans of pesticide, delivering fizzy drinks, catching and stacking newly cut planks in a British Columbia logging camp for just 3 weeks. And there was writing and editing jobs on small-town newspapers and magazines. I fell in and out of love and wrote and played not very good soft rock songs. I swallowed whole the mind-bending books of the time. 100 Years of Solitude and The Prophet amongst them, as well as some nicely written blockbusters, such things as One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Catch-22, and The Ginger Man. The background noise to the hippie lifestyle thing was serious politics, Vietnam and the domestic mayhem that went with it. With the bursting of the happy hippie bubble, and by now back in London, I began reading up on politics. My day job was as a rock writer for the New Musical Express, interviewing musicians who were often global brands and reviewing their records and concerts. My political reading included mainstream authors such as Anthony Sampson and Bernard Crick, but I was soon into the heavy stuff. I've kept some of them as a memento of a vanished age of intensely serious left activism. I no longer have Gaddafi's Little Green Book, but I remember it being a reasoned and persuasive tract. But I do still have Lenin's The State and Revolution, Marx and Engels' Manifesto of the Communist Party, Mao Zedong's On Policy, and Mao again on The Present Situation and Our Tasks. A more intelligent little volume was Energy and Equity by Ivan Illich. By the time I'd finished with these books and others like them, I was convinced not only I wasn't a collectivist or an anarcho-syndicalist or a left libertarian, I knew that there is no doctrine or ideology on earth that can solve the problem of the human race and what we are doing to the globe and to each other. Those books certainly taught me, however, not to submit to authority and certainty just because it is demanded. But then it wasn't just the books that informed me. It was everything I had seen so far, beginning with familial abandonment into the orphanage and, while there, observing how easy it is for the inconspicuous to fall through the cracks. The hippie ideal of love and peace still lived in me, even though I had no more need for the beads and Zapata moustache. After around 3 years, I'd had enough of the rock press and all the drugged-up multicoloured trivia that went with it. It was difficult in those days to switch from music magazines to doing grown-up pieces for the mainstream press. We rock hacks were condescended to, even though Fleet Street was busy copying the rapid, biting prose found especially in the NME, and also its vibrant layouts and typography. I did make the switch and worked for around a decade doing news features for titles such as Time Out, The Independent, and The Guardian. Subject matters was the grimy end of town, the part that Westminster forgot. It was about child beggars, street drug culture, racism, knife gangs, gym addicts. And then I learnt more about the way we treat animals. So there were pieces on intensive farming, animal slaughter, the trade in exotic pets, the untold story of zoos, as well as some pieces about the fate of animals in laboratories. Scientists had recently completed coding the entire human genome. Their tails were high. We had entered a new, endlessly creative era of unstoppable science. And so, if I were to ask myself where this infallible creed of science, especially biological science, takes us, I would say Hiroshima, 1945, and also to the monkey experiments conducted at Oxford University's Department of Experimental Psychology. It goes additionally to Richard Dawkins, that most polished of evangelists, a former Oxford University professor for public understanding of science, who exhorts and beats the drum for the scientific method. Dawkins, by trade, is an ethologist and evolutionary biologist. He is also a practiced God-baiter. The God Delusion, published in 2006, was a sharply argued demolition of the idea of a supernatural creator. Dawkins' contempt for religion, which he sees as a source of much dangerously unhinged thinking, runs as deep as his zealous regard for science. Science is the means of understanding the world and shaping it for the better. In numerous YouTube debates, we see Dawkins go head-to-head with Christian creationists or conservative Muslims. He is invariably calmly incisive. But when his patience deserts him, the infallible scientist makes an appearance and the argument then begins to look like two-headed fundamentalism trying to bite itself. Some of his admirers have lost faith, One took to the Huffington Post to complain that he was now practicing a narcissistic, anti-religious extremism that flirts with outright racism. Dawkins, not unreasonably, believes that a person can experience spiritual feeling without submitting to an invisible deity. As examples, he has spoken of a tour he made of a giant telescope in Hawaii, also a visit to CERN's Large Hadron Collider. This last experience moved him to tears. It was the wonder of the collider itself, a piece of man-made scientific kit that got to him. Is it fair to say from this that what Dawkins worships are the work of human beings, especially those of fellow scientists? If so, is it man the creator he sees when he looks in a mirror? And why am I picking on Dawkins? If I'm honest, it is out of revenge for something he didn't actually do and might not even approved of, the vile brain experiments on monkeys conducted at Oxford and Cambridge universities. I cannot fathom how educated minds can engage in such meticulously planned cruelty, other than to presume that they see themselves as exempt from normal moral considerations because they are scientists. And science, as Dawkins has said in a televised Oxford debate, is not concerned with right or wrong, only truth. Truth is arrived at by gathering evidence using the scientific method. It is society's role to debate how science is to be deployed and where its limits should lie. It is that certainty that I now find objectionable. Evidence and truth are disputable. Scientists often disagree about what a set of scientifically arrived at facts denote. Sometimes, by further methodical testing, a synthesis of their original contrary positions can be reached, and sometimes it can't. That's because the scientific method is not an infallible problem solver or truth finder. It is merely a mechanism, potentially an extraordinarily valuable one, for seeking answers. Besides, the critical element missing from Dawkins' hubristic version of science is that scientists are rarely free agents. They are not the guileless truth-seeking boffins of old movies. Instead, they serve commerce or politics, or they are on the lookout for a project that will earn them grant funding. These are the determinants of the science that is done and the use to which it is put. I can't imagine what kind of truth the Oxford and Cambridge brain-damaging teams were hoping to discover. A truth I saw is that they caused immense suffering to animals whose lives they controlled. In fact, they would have faced imprisonment for the cruelty they inflicted, if not for the immunity afforded by a special Home Office license. I'll come later to how and why animals came to mean so much to me. Meanwhile, let me simply report that I had been the director of Animal Aid for 3 years when I read the Oxbridge monkey papers. Our scientific consultant found the Oxford experiment and 11 similar examples in a search of the scientific literature. We went public with them as winners of our annual Mad Science Awards. The declared goal of the Oxford team was to study the effect of catastrophic brain damage on emotion and motivation. The damage was done with toxic chemicals and through the surgical removal of different parts of the cortex. To the caged marmosets, terrified of what might come next, the researchers would have seemed like gods, mysterious and all-powerful. After coming round from the surgery, they were given a series of frustration tasks. One involved depriving them of food, and then, when they were desperate for it, placing food in front of them but beyond their reach. The starving, brain-damaged monkeys resorted to biting their own limbs and licking the bar gates, outcomes that were recorded. In other tests, monkeys in the same condition were manipulated into pressing a button 900 times in a single session to obtain just 60 peanuts. Cambridge University researchers, it turned out, had no trouble matching their Oxford counterparts. A Mad Science winner a few years later saw 12 marmosets each receive 10 or more separate injections of a seizure-causing chemical directly into two regions of their brain. After recovery from their post-operative seizures, there were months of dexterity tests before they were cured. The tests included having to reach out and retrieve food rewards, sometimes with one hand covered in gauze and immobilized by sticking plaster, or else their feet were bound in a sticky postal labels and the researchers checked how long it took to bite and tear their way free. The part of the project that clinched their Mad Science Award involved injecting the marmosets with the drug apomorphine. This caused them to spin uncontrollably in their cages, as many as 300 times in a 60-minute session. The research team said their experiments were aimed at advancing treatments of Huntington's disease, but being familiar with the scientific literature, we knew that years of neurological animal experiments had shown that animal models are consistently unreliable surrogates for human beings. Monkeys are not people. The human diseases researchers aim to simulate in them are artificial, untranslatable constructs. And because different species often respond to the same drug differently, when novel compounds are tested on these pretend humans, the results can't be trusted. How did I get to feel so strongly about animal exploitation? It had been brewing for years, but had come to a head during that decade in Fleet Street. I started out as a generalist freelance writer, specializing in street-level human dramas. But my mask eventually slipped to reveal what I had become, a pro-animal zealot. Readers quite like animal stories, but they prefer them when they end, let's exaggerate to make a point, with puppy dogs in a basket tied up with ribbons. My stories were likely to end with rows of pigs shackled upside down in a slaughterhouse, blood gushing from their slashed throats. That didn't automatically disqualify them because the media likes a bit of grit in the mix too, and a fair number of mine in that vein were published. The trouble came when I sought to paint the bigger picture, pointing out that in the case of animal slaughter, the raw brutality I was describing was not aberrant behaviour by a handful of bad guys. It was state-authorised, commercially rewarded killing and butchery. The established industry term for what I had seen is humane slaughter, but the deceit runs deeper still. The main animal welfare statute recognises two types of deliberately inflicted suffering, necessary and unnecessary. Only the first of which is lawful. Blinding cats and cutting out the hearts of healthy dogs results in unnecessary suffering, which is unlawful, unless, as previously noted, you're a researcher and have a home office license. Similarly, a gang of 9 and 10-year-old city kids who capture a squirrel and club the animal to death, or who get hold of a gun and shoot birds because they take pleasure in the kill, they will be ranked as criminals in need of correction. But the same kids can do the same thing a couple of miles away out in the woods if it's overseen by an adult who has the right paperwork. Then it becomes not just legal, but character building. The dozens of books and pamphlets I'd read on politics, class, ideology, forced consciousness and the rest, they had left this out. Why? Why did animals with whom I'd long felt a special bond not feature as active players in these tracks? The writings claim to know how to fix much of what ails humanity, from problems of poverty to unregulated commerce, but the role and plight of animals were glaringly absent. The reason for their absence, to my mind, is simple. Wherever the lowest-ranked category of human beings can be found, animals are beneath them. They fall lower, even than Marx and Engels, lumpen proletariat. Animals in law are property. They are objects, which is why they do not appear in political tracks designed to advance the cause of autonomous beings. Having the status of objects means that animals can be lawfully traded, multiplied, and killed. They can be killed for a particular purpose or for no purpose at all. That holds for the roughly 1 billion animals slaughtered annually in the UK, as well as for the millions more who are shot, hunted, raced, put on display, and vivisected. If intense book reading and travel led me to this new understanding of animals as disposable commodities, from where did I get my big tender feelings from them? It was these feelings, I said to my mirror reflection one cold morning, that made the way they are treated matter so much to me. In fact, matter more and more as each day passed. It would be fanciful to imagine I could know precisely where such strong feelings come from, but there are two events that my mind won't let go of. One is the little bird who flew over and over again at that glass panel above the main entrance of the office I worked in. I was perhaps 16 at the time. The second happened some 15 years later, when I was lining up to make a purchase outside an old-fashioned North London fishmonger. A couple of feet from me, stretched out on a stone slab, was a large cod. From somewhere around her middle, blood was seeping. It kept coming all the while I stood in line, this savage waiting for his flesh. I thought of a human baby bleeding on a slab. It was then, or soon after, that the decisive question began forming in my mind and in my gut. How fucking dare we do this? We are killing all these animals who don't want to suffer at our hands and be killed, but we carry on doing it. That feeling of wounded outrage grew into what I don't mind calling an obsession, a devotional obsession that derives from what had become a sense of mission. To some people, it would have looked like, yes, a weakness of the mind, mental derangement, and I suppose I was semi-deranged by the feelings welling inside of me. But while we anti-religious types aren't supposed to talk in airy, flyaway terms such as mission, obsession and quest, that's what it came to feel like. Among some Native American cultures, young men looking to experience their own divine vision that will help them find their purpose in life go on what is known in the popular jargon as a vision quest. It's organized by elders, supported by the young men's community, and usually consists of several days of fasting, praying and crying out to the spirits to be delivered of a vision. There were, predictably, bastardized New Age versions of the vision rite, the most notorious of which was run by one James Arthur Ray, whose $10,000 a shot adepts allowed themselves to be subjected to such severe travails that three of them died and 18 were hospitalized, suffering burns, dehydration, kidney failure, breathing problems, and elevated body temperature. This came about as a result of a 2009 session in the Angel Valley Retreat near Sedona, Arizona. It seems that the attendees had fasted for 36 hours in the desert before locking themselves in the sweatshop retreat, not having drunk water for 2 days. James Arthur Ray is still in the motivational speaking business, despite that 2009 episode, landing him with a conviction for negligent homicide. The vision quest, in the hands of a crude exponent, fares badly. Yet history throws up many examples of spectacular encounters with the force beyond by serious figures looking for the big pointing finger that will show them the way. An example is René Descartes, French philosopher, mathematician, and scientist, who was born in 1596. Descartes was said to have formulated analytical geometry, plus the idea of applying the mathematical method to philosophy, after witnessing three visions, delivered to him by what he took to be a divine spirit. The name Descartes is one that is uttered with a curse in anti-vivisection circles. He is said to have denied that animals could have reason or intelligence, or could feel pain, and claiming that they could therefore be used without restraint. His experiments are models of high-minded savagery. Other sources say that Descartes' reading of animals was more nuanced. All the same, Descartes and Cartesian remain hate-filled terms in animal advocacy circles more than 320 years after his birth. Paul the Apostle had a vision whose consequences were more resonant even than Descartes' analytical geometrics. It was while on his much-cited walk to Damascus that he experienced a vision of the resurrected Jesus. Whereupon Paul fell to the ground, denied to Jesus he was persecuting him, and was struck blind for 3 days. When his sight returned, he was baptized, and thereafter followed a life proselytizing for Jesus. My own travels back and forth across the USA and Canada were, by contrast, modest, but they did turn out to be a hard and valuable proving ground for a nervy South London boy who, although he didn't know it at the time, was not unlike the lion in The Wizard of Oz, looking to find courage and his roar, and like Dorothy herself, wanting something to believe in. And so now I was at Animal Aid, trying with colleagues to alert the world to those depraved Oxford and Cambridge monkey experiments. I was to stay another 16 years, 21 in all, before Parkinson's disease, which caused my limbs to ache and twitch or refuse to move, and which stops me from sleeping at night, brought it to an end. I don't attribute my Parkinson's to the up-close animal suffering I've witnessed over the years, but the shuddering, tremulous outward manifestations of my condition pretty much sum up the feeling I'm left with after watching defenseless animals being bullied and killed. That makes it essential to remind myself that there are animals out there whose stories don't end up badly. It helps also to reflect on the extraordinary qualities of so many apparently ordinary, even inconsequential animals. The goldcrest, for instance. The goldcrest is the tiniest bird seen on the British Islands. Weighing just 6 grams or 1/5 of 1 ounce, they are giants when it comes to ambition and staying power. A national newspaper columnist described encountering several exhausted, half-starved goldcrests on a stretch of North Norfolk coastline. They were determinedly searching for food along the base of a sea wall, and then later among some pine trees that reached to the salty dunes. Incredibly, they had flown all the way over the North Sea, probably from Scandinavia. That's likely to be a 1,000-mile journey. Goldcrests are easy to admire, less so the much persecuted pigeon. But that's because most people have not looked hard enough to see the qualities of pigeons. Philip the pigeon lived with my wife Sarah and me for nearly 6 years. An old lady named Phyllis found him wandering around our hometown of Tunbridge in June 2006. His right wing, which drooped slightly, wouldn't carry him off the ground, although there were no signs of it having been broken. Philip lived in the scullery part of our kitchen, overlooking our little courtyard garden. On a shelf 3 feet off the ground, Sarah had fashioned him a couple of adjoining rooms made from cardboard boxes, each one furnished with a couple of logs on which to perch, and a multi-layered carpet of newspapers that was kept clean by removing sheets around 5 times a day as they got dirty. Initially, we allowed Philip access to the garden only for as long as he was caged and safe. But the caging just made him feel vulnerable. And of course, that isn't freedom. And so we let him wander freely, though we pretty constantly monitored his progress. Philip had plenty of visitors. He tried to woo some of the girl pigeons while driving off troublesome males. Other males he made friends with. He had a little box at the foot of his scullery area, and when he climbed on the log within that, we knew he wanted to be lifted back onto his shelf. And he would tell us, at dusk, when he was ready for bed, by pacing back and forth on top of his house. Every night we covered his area with a blackout blanket. When the mood took him, he'd wander about the kitchen or visit us in the sitting room, parking himself on a log in a basket facing the couch, untroubled by our 5 dogs. He felt at home with us, but remained wild, never quite trusting us and not wanted to be handled. I said to him many times, "I wish you'd let me pick you up and give you a big kiss, but I should have been careful what I wish for." On a February morning, he had a stroke and dragged himself unseen behind a water butt. We found him within minutes, but his legs were already gone. He couldn't walk. We thought at first that a cat had got him, or that a gust of wind had dashed him against a wall or a door. but he was unmarked. He had another stroke 2 days later and died in his bed. Shortly before he went, my wife had held and caressed him in an attempt to restore movement, and then I did the same for 10 minutes, short of 2 hours. We knew him well enough to recognise that he took great pleasure from all the attention we paid him in his last hours. How bitterly ironic that, at the very last, he finally worked out that we could be trusted, and I got to hold him. It is the plight of the lowly ranked animals, pigeons, grey squirrels, rats and mice, that have most concerned me during my time at Animal Aid. They are the contemptible ones, the vermin, pests and non-natives who are stalked all year round by killing gangs, some of them funded with taxpayers' money. The Home Office, which is the government department charged with licensing and regulating animal experiments, uses a reverse strategy when it comes to mice. Rather than shrink their total number, it oversees their mass breeding, usually with deliberately induced genetic weaknesses. This is so that they can be exploited with brutal inefficiency by researchers who tell us they are about to unlock the secret of why human beings get sick and how to cure them. The massive overbreeding of genetically modified animals can be seen in the Home Office's annual report on scientific procedures. In the 2014 edition, nearly 2 million GM animals, mostly mice, were incinerated, many of them soon after birth, having been assessed by the establishments concerned as being surplus to needs. How can such a vast and brutally witless enterprise exist? In addition to the mice who went from the breeding units to the incinerator, approximately 620,000 GM animals in 2014 had to endure actual experiments. Such procedures have included the infliction of deliberate brain damage, chemical poisoning and forced swimming to the point of exhaustion. The Home Office drops soft hints to the public that GM rodents are not to be thought of in the same way as supposedly far more cognitively complex animals such as dogs and horses. Rather, they seem to be saying they are to be thought of as more like laboratory equipment. Such heartlessness is very much not a product of ignorance. The recasting of mice as quasi-lab tools, without true feelings, is an essential feature of the doctrine that underpins and justifies their systematic exploitation. There is, in fact, much to admire about mus musculus. Mouse pups are born deaf and blind and require devoted nursing and protection to survive. Male mice use love songs, pitched at an ultrasonic level, to court females who vigorously clean themselves all over to show interest. These are the free-living animals, lab-bred mice who are warehoused in plastic boxes and stacked in racks, have little chance to express who they are. And yet, every mouse in every lab is real and individual. And when they call out for an end to their suffering, at a sonic pitch, researchers are deaf to, their cry is as meaningful as anything a richly plumaged bird on the wing, a goldcrest, for instance, can muster. I should acknowledge at this point that the skinny, anxious kid who was dropped off at the South London orphanage 65 years ago has stuck around with me ever since. Whenever there was a specially difficult moment, I was likely to feel his tremulous, shaky presence, daring me to convince him that things weren't as bleakly terrifying as they seemed. How could they be? I would assure myself. This was everyday life. And so I'd grit my teeth, take a breath, and face it. The Home Office headquarters building, with its ponderous latticework fascia and flowing streams that draw you from pavement to main entrance, is typical of the not-quite-daring architecture that governments often favour. The department oversees the police and prisons, immigration, the illicit drug scene, and yes, animal experimentation. All are potentially fraught areas, which is why visitors to the building, from lobbyists to gang violence victims, are made to realise that histrionics won't help them. To become impassioned is to risk being discounted as unsound. to show how much your thing matters to you is to be out of control. This core message is conveyed the moment you arrive, via the building's monumental facade and by the languid manners of officials, some of whom are not given to raising their voices much above the barely audible. I would go to the Home Office headquarters to meet officials every 3 months or so, together with a fellow campaigner from Animal Aid and our counterparts in two or three other animal groups. The agenda that officials prepared for us would include several time-consuming items relating to internal IT upgrades or some such administrative challenge. We would start by getting the agenda changed to include matters that would take us beneath the superficial crust, down to what that crust hides, the bloody, brain-crushing, bone-breaking reality of the research they were giving permission for in pharmaceutical company labs and university research departments across the country. My 9-year-old voice would warn me not to trip up in the presence of the department's well-versed, slippery operators. But to hell with all that. Daring to be who you are and say and do what you feel in defence of those who cannot defend themselves, there can be little else that is more important in life. Those meetings may not have been world-changing, although practical policy measures that helped animals did come from them. But the way they succeeded was to remind key people at the heart of the vivisection project that we were there always, perched on their shoulders, watching them as they go about their regulatory business. Weirdly, those key people who are central to vivisection are veterinary surgeons. Ask people in the street about vets and they will say they are committed to healing and never deliberately harming animals. But it is Home Office employed vets working as the inspectorate who approve and issue licenses for the 4 million plus procedures that take place every year. The involvement of veterinary surgeons in organised animal exploitation is still something that can throw me off balance. Perhaps the unbeatable example is the Royal Veterinary College, whose researchers conduct thousands of experiments on animals each year. Search the scientific literature and you will find papers describing how RVC people have surgically mutilated pregnant sheep to study uterine blood flow, dosed beagle dogs with a chemotherapy drug that made them sick and nauseous, and so on. But it goes much further. At the heart of most systems of production line animal cruelty are vets. I include the animal farming and slaughter industries as well as commercial horse racing. Specialist vets are hired not simply to explain away the ugly aspects of such businesses, everything from caged hens to broken-backed thoroughbreds. Some of them provide expertise on matters such as reproductive potential, disease control, and growth efficiency. Yet, I hear it said, if vets weren't in the midst of it all, things would be far worse. But how much worse would animal slaughter be? For instance, without a veterinary monitoring system that Animal Aid's extensive undercover filming showed to be of zero benefit to those animals being violently killed. What vets in such settings actually provide is a patina of respectability. They give the nod to industries and practices that members of their profession should scorn. Over the years, I have seen firsthand many cases where vets have provided cover for animal farmers who are under fire for serious welfare lapses. A recent case in which Animal Aid was directly involved concerned a South of England egg producer. The company already had several egg farms and was now seeking permission from the local authority to build a vast new free-range unit that would have confined 64,000 hens at a time in two adjoining sheds. The birds' access to the outside world would have been limited. As part of our submission to the local authority, in which we opposed the plan, we included an undercover film we had shot in another of the firm's units. This showed thousands of hens packed into row upon row of metal cages. Many of the birds were frantic, bedraggled, and suffering extreme feather loss that left much of their pale, yellow bodies virtually without cover. The look in their eyes was pitiful, and there was a desperate note to their raw, insistent calls. Hens are family-minded social animals who, when free, engage in elaborate courtship and nesting behaviour. They go on to fiercely guard their chicks. During the nesting season, they want some seclusion and tranquility. I can think of no more dismal a fate for a hen than to find herself in the raucous, fetid bedlam that is the modern egg production unit. Here she is caged with a dozen or more birds, unable to flap her wings properly or move more than a few inches. Before submitting our footage to the council, we showed it to a vet specialising in hens. In his first response, he said he could see no contravention of relevant welfare legislation. When pressed as to whether he personally felt the birds were in an acceptable condition, he ducked the question, referring instead to the industry's constant and positive drive on welfare standards. The practitioner, it turned out, was a high-ranking poultry specialist, a man prominent within industry advisory and research bodies, and whose clients included multinational enterprises. I wondered, after seeing his comments, what threshold of hen suffering and misery would have to be crossed before well-embedded, generously remunerated expert practitioners roused themselves. Part of the answer, I suspect, lies in the secondary status of veterinary surgeons' animal patients. It is the bill-paying owner, whether of one dog or a million chickens, who commands the vet's loyalty. The common view of chickens is of dim, graceless birds, and yet people who know them know that this characterization is a travesty. An equivalent situation holds for fish. They too are thought little of because of a presumed inability to think or feel properly. This view prevails despite all the skills and resourcefulness fish need to find shelter and food, produce young and keep those young safe long enough for the biological line to continue. The positive attributes of fish don't interest anglers and many fish meat consumers. It is the negative stereotype that appeals to them. After all, if fish can't properly feel or think, then, hey presto, that's another moral quandary dealt with. But what is really going on in the cerebral cortex of a bird or small mammal, or in the anatomical equivalent found in fish? There is a thriving strand of science dedicated to answering this useless question by examining the mental and physical resources of a range of species. The quotient tests set by these giants of scientific inquiry invariably involve challenging the animals with something noxious, something that burns, cuts, incapacitates, or shocks them into compliance. There are, additionally, the numbingly repetitive tests involving keyboards and food. When these tests demonstrate that the animal being studied is more intelligent than was supposed, the public declares itself vaguely interested, and more tests are undertaken to gather further evidence that will again be essentially ignored. For the animal, there is no reprieve. The clever sheep still ends up in the oven. Animals don't need to demonstrate their attributes to human beings. They have nothing to prove to us. It is we who need to show that we are capable of living intelligently, cooperatively, and peacefully on this earth. The animal intelligence tests are, in any case, absurd because they value as supreme an animal's ability to mimic human beings, while passing off as mere instinct or simply not noticing remarkable behaviour by animals that people are incapable of matching. An extension of this shallow thinking is our conviction that animals who look like us, notably monkeys, are clever like we are. But is a rhesus macaque monkey cleverer than a squirrel, a chicken, or a rat? The answer depends on how observations and data are processed and the motivation of those controlling the test. Just how clever is a chicken? A lorry carrying nearly 7,000 former egg-laying hens crashed in May 2014 on the M62 on its way to a slaughterhouse. Some 1,500 birds were killed outright by the collision, and many more had devastating injuries. Crates were scattered over the three lanes of the motorway. Stricken hens were everywhere, some mutilated in broken containers. Workers from a local poultry farm were called. They caught handfuls of birds by their legs and brutally forced them back into the crates without first checking for injuries. The traumatized chickens were eventually loaded onto a replacement lorry. "We woke to the sounds of chickens screaming," Louise Fields told Animal Aid. She runs an animal sanctuary close to the crash site. Louise and her partner, Emma Billington, along with police and highways agency officers, spent the next 3 hours moving the hens onto the relative safety of the motorway verge and then into the adjacent field. Louise and Emma saved at least 3,000 birds from the crash site and quickly rehomed most of them. They could do nothing to prevent others being loaded onto a replacement transporter and completing their journey to the slaughterhouse or processing plant, the term favoured by the chicken-killing industry. Emma and Louise continue to rescue hens found wandering in the area 7 weeks after the crash. When they thought there were no more survivors, they found Lucky. She had survived for more than 2 months, a feat of endurance, stamina, and resourcefulness that beats, in my mind, the accomplishments of those early polar explorers. Lucky had been reared in a vast shed crowded with other birds, but with no one to look out for her, the crash would have left her traumatized. She was pitched out into the unknown territory, marked by a narrow strip of ground, with motor vehicles thundering all around her day and night. But she made it. She didn't fall through the cracks. And so I say to her, I salute you, Lucky. You took some catching, but you went on to a happy life with people who appreciated and loved you. What could be better? Is that where we end this piece? Or shall I go on to meditate on authority, certainty, fear of freedom, and the need to trust who we really are and dare to be that person? No, we'll end with Lucky the chicken.
And that concludes our audiobook, My Life as an Animal, by Andrew Tyler and read by Jim Smith. Produced by Tom Davidson and adapted for UK Health Radio by Monkey Nut Audiobooks. My Life as an Animal is available on Audible and most audiobook sites. This audiobook is published by Monkey Nut Audiobooks in Hampshire, UK.